Welcome to another episode of No More Reasonable Doubt. Today is a very special episode. It's episode number 50, and it's the last one we're doing for this season. Now, don't be sad for two reasons. One, we have 50 episodes with professionals of color sharing their wisdom. Two, we'll be back. I want to say thank you up front for all the love you've shown this project over the past 50 episodes, dear listeners. In the words of Biggie Smalls, it was all a dream. That dream turned into a vision, which turned into research and research interviews, which turned into the No More Reasonable Doubt movement. I want to say thank you to all my supporters, to all my guests, and give a special shout out to Allison Myers from Counter Tools, who served as my brainstorming partner, my research guru, and my you should keep going homie. I appreciate you, Allison. Another special shout out goes to Joelle Lewis, who served as my podcast mentor on all things technical and analytical. In his words, if you're going to do it, you might as well do it big. Thanks, Joelle. Without further delay, we get into episode 50, which is so freaking good, if I do say so myself. Not because I'm doing the interviewing, but because you get to hear from Marcus Whitney, a brother who is doing his thing and is truly an inspiration. I do not use the word inspiration often or lightly. Enjoy, and I'll see you on the other side. Our goal still stays the same: to take young professionals of color from invisible to invincible. Peace.
You know, and I think you already know this, but this is maybe just as a point of encouragement. We just need to do the work. Just do the work. You know? Do the work for the sake of doing the work. We have these desired outcomes, and it's great to have desires because sometimes they help to get you motivated. But at the end of the day, we have to know that the work is worthy of doing for the sake of doing it, because we don't actually know how everything is going
to
play out.
Hey, this is Mike Ambassador Bruni, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of No More Reasonable Doubt, a show focused on empowering young professionals of color who are just starting their career. We help to remove doubt, gain confidence, and have more impact at work. One important piece to making all this happen is getting exposure to different people and career paths. Today, our special guest is Marcus Whitney. Marcus is the president of Jumpstart Foundry and founder / CEO of The Unlikely Company. Welcome, Marcus.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Appreciate it.
Totally our pleasure. Now, Marcus, one of the questions that we like to start off with is, where are you originally from?
Yeah, man, that's easy. Always proud to talk about where I'm from. So I was born and raised in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, New York.
Yes, yes. So one I can relate to. I think, man. We had this discussion before. East Flatbush, where?
East 58th Street between Tilden and Snyder. So, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
I see it. Yeah. I'm Hawthorne Street in Ostrand Rogers. So.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah, man. So tell us more about what you do for work. You know, this question I got to work on because it says the next part is like, what's the day-to-day like? But really, the frame I want to give you is that there's a young professional of color, and they're exploring different things and they're hearing about different things, but they don't know what it means. How would you kind of frame the two different things you have going on, one as a president of Jumpstart Foundry and then also as the CEO of Unlikely Company?
Yeah, so we'll start with Jumpstart Foundry. So Jumpstart Foundry, in the simplest terms, is an investment firm. So if you can understand what those two words mean, then you're on track. Now how we do our investing is a lot different from maybe what you might think of, but at the end of the day, we are an investment firm. We invest in healthcare companies, specifically healthcare technology companies. And it's usually what we would call early stage healthcare technology companies. So these are companies that, they're up and running. They've got a team. They've built out some really cool technology that can really help people and that would be great to take to market. market, but maybe they haven't gotten a lot of traction yet. Maybe they don't have the connections to the right people. Maybe they're not great at marketing. And so what we do is we come in and we provide them with some investment dollars. You know, we invest $100,000 into each company we invest in. And then we also kind of roll up our sleeves and we partner with them to help them to grow their business. So we have good relationships and insight into the healthcare industry. We know a lot about what the healthcare industry needs and also how they like things to be presented to them. And so we help the companies that we invest in to get more traction in the healthcare industry and get there faster. Because when you are an early stage company, you know, the thing that you have most against you is time. You can't take too long to make a lot of traction in the market because two things. One, that, you know, every day that you're not making a profit, you are losing money. And two, the longer that you're out there and you're not getting traction, you start to lose momentum, and both the market and even the people on your team start to kind of lose faith that what you're going to do is going to work. So we try to, you know, help those companies make the most of their time. That's basically Jumpstart Foundry in a nutshell.
Wow, that's amazing. I know there are some questions that come up for me, and let me know if it's going to be answered when you speak about the unlikely company, because I'm thinking that there's someone who's chilling on Tilden right now, and they're trying to figure out how did this guy go from right where I'm standing to where he is. Like, no one around me was ever talking about investing, and definitely not talking about investing in a company. If anything, you know, maybe investing in a stock.
Yep. Yeah, sure. Hey, look, you know, I was that person. So, you know, I think maybe we'll just start with, I was born and raised in East Flatbush, Brooklyn. And, you know, I was part of all those same conversations. And the only investing that I ever understood, you know, I think from the frame of what you're talking about was stock market investing. And then, you know, you get a little bit older, you have more conversations, you start learning about real estate investing and things like that. For me, it definitely was not a straight line. I got into this line of business ultimately because I was a technology entrepreneur. I was, you know, out trying to create software and trying to create startup companies around that software and then, you know, sell that software. And you start realizing how difficult that is, and you start learning so much about that world. And I would say the one thing that I was you know, I would just encourage anybody who's out there. I was just really always very curious about how things actually worked. I always wanted to know, like, what was happening behind the scenes to actually, you know, make some of these companies that we see get as big as they got, get that big. And so like a lot of people, I was just looking at companies like Facebook or Google. And that was really when I first started to understand the role that venture capital, which is the type of investment that I'm involved in, that's when I understood the role of venture capital in these types of companies. And, you know, I just started studying it along with everything else. And it wasn't always studying from a distance. I started to make friends with people in the industry, hang around a lot, read a lot, watch a lot of videos, started going to a lot of events. And, you know, it's just a matter of hustle. It's just a matter of, you know, deciding that this is something that you want to understand, you want to learn more about, and then, you know, just pushing, you know, pushing towards that.
Great. Thanks for answering that. Do you want to tell us more about the unlikely company?
Sure. So it's actually the other side of that same coin. So as I kept pushing and I kept, you know, learning and being exposed and, you know, ultimately being accepted into more situations, I realized how unlikely it was for me to be doing the things that I was doing. And also, you know, how unlikely it was that I would see other people that looked like me. You know, and really it wasn't just look like me. I mean, it was just kind of a total lack of diversity, in the boardroom and, you know, around the investment decision-making table. And honestly, even, you know, around the whiteboard, you know, drawing up plans for software. These were all places where, you know, I was an unlikely participant, you know, simply based on, you know, demographics and even, you know, educational attainment. And so, you know, for those reasons, I really started to reflect on that. And I also started to look at myself in the context of other people. I never, you know, I always did this because it was something I was passionate about, but also because I have two teenage boys now. But when I started this path, they were babies, and, you know, I wanted to be able to provide for them. And so I was just heads down for the last 15 years, just working hard, trying to make something, of this situation and of myself. And I looked up probably 2 years ago, when I did a TEDx talk here in Nashville, where I currently live. I realized the impact that my story had on so many people. And I also started to kind of see that I was looked at as someone who had accomplished a lot of things. I never really reflected on that, because I was always looking at people who had accomplished more than me. And so I was always striving to be like them. I had never really taken a second to stop and look at where I had arrived in the context of, you know, the general population, if that makes sense. During my own personal journey, I went from waiting tables to, you know, making investment decisions and writing checks and raising millions of dollars and leading teams of people and, you know, selling software to some of the biggest companies in the world. And so it was a pretty significant, change of environment and change of position. And, it personally, for me and for my family, it meant economic mobility, which, for anybody who doesn't know what that term means, it means, basically the American dream, you know, starting out in one tax bracket and moving your way up to be able to provide better education situation for your family, be able to, you know, travel a little bit and experience more cultures, and just, you know, be able to enjoy your life. And so I started looking at what had happened for me, given the fact that personally, I never even finished college, and that this was all happening for me, and that many people I knew who had finished college, even had, you know, graduate degrees, were not experiencing the same level of economic mobility. I started to make a connection between entrepreneurship, the path of entrepreneurship, and this kind of fast track to be able to, you know, bypass any of the limiting factors. And I started thinking about, why aren't more people making an attempt at being an entrepreneur if it is a path to economic mobility that can bypass credentials in many cases. You know, the wonderful thing about the free enterprise in the market is that it's all about creating value and proving that you can create value that the market wants, that consumers will buy. And, consumers don't ask for credentials when they see something of value. You know what I mean? They're just like, hey, this is something of value. Here's my money. So, it just is kind of this fast track. And I just noticed that there was a lack of people, across all demographics, really, in America, who felt confident and comfortable, you know, making a go at it. And so the Unlikely Company was my idea to maybe try to demystify some of some of what it means to be an entrepreneur in the 21st century in America, where it's a little bit different than it was in the past. We are now in a global economy. No matter where you are in the world, you're competing with people all over the world, generally speaking. Technology has made things easier than ever to get up and running and kind of do very, very sophisticated businesses. But at the same time, the number of competitors has never been so many. There's just lots of things that I think have made people uneasy, you know, if they're not digitally savvy or they haven't spent a lot of time in the startup space, they don't know a lot about angel investing or venture capital. And I wanted to try to demystify some of that to make it more accessible for the average person.
So now, how are you doing that with the Unlikely Company?
That's a great question. So how we decided to see if the Unlikely Company was going to work is a friend of mine, Jacob, who had been hearing me talk about this for a while, and I, we launched a Kickstarter campaign for a book that I'm currently, you know, plugging away at, called Create and Orchestrate. It was named after some of the kind of a part of the topic that I spoke about in my TEDx Nashville talk about hustling. And, a really big thing in the startup world right now is this concept of validation, which is, you know, before you start spending a whole lot of money on something, building something out, it's a great idea to try and see if it's something the market actually wants. And the beauty of technology today is through things like Kickstarter and even running, you know, small advertisement campaigns, you can start to validate your ideas, you know, instead of spending a lot of time and money and energy trying to build something that nobody wants. And so we launched The Unlikely Company by creating a Kickstarter campaign. We just put it out there, said, hey, we're going to, we want to write this book that's going to teach, you know, all of America how to actually, you know, launch a business, and try and do it in a principled way and kind of the most general and demystifying way as possible. And we set a $20,000 goal out there, which I felt was not, you know, wasn't $1 million goal, but $20,000 is probably a pretty good sign that that there is an actual market out there for it. Mm-hmm. Launched a campaign, and it was funded in 12 hours. So wow. that was kind of our marching orders to go forth and create The Unlikely Company.
That is awesome, man. Now, what advice would you give to someone who aspires to do what you do and is just starting out?
There are a couple of things that I think are really important. So the first thing I would say is, you know, just start. And I don't say that to be I'm not trying to oversimplify things, because I really do believe, and this is a big part of my book, that businesses are actually complex systems. It's hard to get good at it without time and without experience and the inevitable mistakes that you will make. And so the reason why I say just start is because you have to start the process of learning and start the process of making mistakes, you know, as soon as possible. All of the real learning happens through doing in entrepreneurship. That's 100% the truth. And so much of the learning is really about knowledge of self. It's about, you know, learning about what your natural talents are, what things, you know, help you get a boost in energy, what things drag your energy, how well you work with people in collaborative settings, how you respond to competition. So a lot of entrepreneurship is about doing and learning about yourself. And then also, seek mentorship. I would say both peer mentorship and also the wise ones, people who have been where you want to go. The peer mentors are great because these are people who are probably in the trenches going through very similar experiences to what you're currently going through. And they can empathize with you, and sometimes they can call you on your junk. You know, sometimes we get a little down on ourselves, and woe is me and kind of all this stuff. And, you know, usually a good peer mentor can kind of slap you out of that. And then the wise ones, the people who have been where we want to go, those are people who, if we're truly, truly listening, they can save us the time and energy and hurt from making some of the mistakes that they've made. And that's really an invaluable thing. And also those people, you know, if you're really listening, usually can make some connections for you, can guide you, can open up some doors for some opportunities and things like that. So mentorship, both peer as well as kind of the more advanced mentor, those are always great things to do. And I think critical in the life of most entrepreneurs. Back to your point of exposure.
Great. It's interesting because I'll tell you where my brain is going. A couple things. if I'm totally honest, one is like, all right, what do you do when you run out of money? That was one.
Yeah.
And then with the learning. And then the other thing that came to my mind was that, hey, peer and even the advanced ones, it's not an age thing. It doesn't feel like it's age.
No. No, it's experience, and that's the thing, right? I mean, you know, some people have just started, you know, earlier, right? And so, and some people started earlier and then had mentors and people that were experienced, and they were able to, you know, age even faster by the exposure and the relationships they had with you know, elders. So, no, it's really not. I mean, age, you know, is about, you know, kind of your amount of experience and being you, but entrepreneurship is a very specific path. It's a specific journey. And, it's a compound, effect of who you surround yourself with and the amount of time that you spent in it that really determines how much of an elder you are to somebody else in the same space.
Right, right. So you can't judge it by gray hairs.
No. I don't believe so. I mean, you know, there's some people who have been entrepreneurs, you know, since they were 5 years old. I mean, literally, like it's hard for some people to believe, but some people grew up in those entrepreneurial households where, you know, the dad or the mom made them get out there and do the lemonade stand or mm-hmm. sell the chocolate bars. You know what I mean? And like, you know, even while they were in school, they always, you know, they were selling baseball cards or trading baseball cards or whatever. I mean, those things are, you know, that's entrepreneurship. You know what I mean? It's being in the hustle and those experiences and negotiating and selling and dealing with rejection. And, you know, if you started that process at 10 or 11 or 12 years old, you know, you're going to be ahead of the person who just gets started with that in their 20s.
Great point. To the question of running out of money. And I guess underneath that, there's a question of like, I'll just say it, it doesn't sound as great anymore, but I was like, do people stop being entrepreneurs?
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, an entrepreneur is what you are, and, you know, a particular business is what you're doing at any given point in time. Now, money is important. You know, the way that I think about business is that there are eight core concepts of business that are deeply connected to each other. And I'll run through them pretty quickly and in order of priority. So leadership, finance, operations, growth. Growth is a very complex one because how to grow a business, both like, you know, growing the customer base and the revenue, but also how to grow internally, grow the number of people, how do you scale? Growth is a very complex part of a business. So it deserves its own kind of category as a concept. And those are kind of all the internal concepts. And then I would say there are four external concepts as well, which would be product, service, sales, and marketing. So if those are the eight core concepts of business, finance is the second most important one after leadership. The reason is once the money runs out, the business is for all intents and purposes gone unless the leader just can pull off an act of, you know, heroics, right, to get it done. But I mean that there's a reality to finances being the blood of the activity of the business. Look, there's some obvious challenges around business for, you know, segments of the population that do not have a lot to start with, right?
Right, right.
And there's obvious advantages to the segments of the population that have a lot to start with, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have to learn how to be crafty. We have to learn how to pull. I would say maybe most importantly, we have to learn how to be disciplined. Because there's probably more money available than we really understand is available. But discipline is a little hard to come by. What are the things you're doing with your money that you could be doing otherwise?
right.
With.
Understood. Oh, thank you for that. That I think is going to free some people up.
I hope so.
And, you have to let us know when that book is ready, man.
Yeah. Hey, look, I'm pushing hard for the middle of February for a street date. So I'm in the lab right now, knocking out anywhere between 500 and 2,500 words a day. And, I think I'll make it.
Awesome. And for all you listeners out there, that's February 2016.
Yes, that's right.
When you're listening.
That's right.
What do you wish you were taught when you were just starting out?
What do I wish I was taught when I was just starting out? You know, it's really funny. As I'm writing this book, a large part of the book is that I was self-taught. And the way that I came into entrepreneurship was from the perspective of a software developer. And so software developers, we're lazy. And so we try to identify patterns in just about anything so that we can kind of, you know, do less work. Like we say, okay, well, this is like that. And so, you know, you always want to reuse code. You always want to make comparisons that can help shorten the amount of work you have to do to figure anything out. And so I really loved the journey, especially in retrospect. I loved how I learned about business, all by kind of having to do, thrown in the deep end, having to figure out how to swim. For me, that was a lot of the fun about it. And I think that's something that I'm hoping to communicate in this book, is that there are so many wonderful gifts in the process of discovery as an entrepreneur. And, you know, I think the shortcuts that people are seeking are mostly because they don't want to deal with, you know, some of the more uncomfortable moments, you know, not really knowing what's going on. The business isn't really having any traction. You're not making a lot of money. You're wanting kind of an external change of state to happen quickly. But ultimately what this is about is it's about a sustained internal change that that has an unbelievable force multiplying effect on everything you do for the rest of your life after that, right? So for example, I mean, if I had just wanted to learn some hack, right, that really, you know, because there's no way to rush true maturing and real growth. So if I wanted to learn some hack that I would have figured out and I would have gotten to get more money quicker, it wouldn't have changed my character in a meaningful way, right? And so the likelihood that I would have blown that money and been right back and maybe even more depressed because I blew the money very quickly versus, you know, really learning to appreciate every significant financial gain I've ever had, because none of them have really come very easy for me. That I'm grateful that it's happened this way. You know, I'm grateful for the path. I'm grateful for the way that it's all unfolded for me personally. And you know, now I feel like there are very few situations that I could get into. You know, I may not be an expert at aerospace or something like that, but I just really believe that I've got this core understanding both of how I operate in a business as a leader and of the way that business fundamentally works that is applicable to so many different situations, that I've got so much flexibility now. And that didn't come easy. You know, that was through a lot of hard work and a lot of commitment and just life lessons.
Excellent, man. Is there, and you might have hit on this, but are there any, kind of talking about that life lesson and you can't rush maturity and development, I make up that with that time there comes unspoken wisdom. Like, no one could have told me this. I don't care. Right? No one could have told me this. And that's what I'm curious about, is what is the unspoken wisdom you've discovered in your career field? Maybe something that kind of hits you on some idle morning or something that you're like, holy crap. Look at this pattern.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are many things, many things that I think I've learned. I will say that very few things have hit me kind of right away. Okay, I'll tell you one thing. I mean, one thing is, and you hear this a lot. But trusting your gut, and the funny thing about that saying, trust your gut, you know, you have to have lived enough life to know the difference between your gut and your ego. They're not always completely distinguishable, I would say, in, you know, your 20s, you know, because in your 20s, you just hear a voice in your head. you start getting into your 30s, and I'm going to be 40 in a couple weeks here, and your gut is an overall, it's a sense. It's different. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not a voice in your head, because the voice in your head is actually pretty still at this point. You know, it's just your gut. You can feel if something is right or not right. And really, listening to your gut and acting from that and trusting that, that's been a marvelous thing that nobody could have told me, but I still think I needed to grow, I needed to grow into that. Look, youth is for the young, right? I mean, there's a certain amount of energy and creativity and wonder that happens in youth. That's just beautiful. And it's supposed to be a little naive. I mean, that's part of the deal. I mean, I look back like really fondly at some of the things, some of the things that I tried to do when I was young. I kind of shudder if I think, okay, well, if I had all this wisdom back then, I mean, gosh, I probably would have been pretty boring, now I'm appropriately boring. I'm a damn 40-year-old, you know what I mean? But like when I was 25, I was fun and stupid, and that's cool, man. That's all right.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because you've given me something to think about in a way that I haven't thought about. And it's that, like, there's a little bit of like, you are where you need to be at this time.
Yeah.
The reason is because one of the things I talk about when I talk about this show is the idea of kind of learning from I'll say professionals of color teaching young professionals of color, if you will. And there's a saying that my dad used to tell me that's like, si jeunesse pouvait, si vieille savait. Basically saying, if the young knew and if the old could.
Right. Yes.
And that's something I guess I may like fantasize about. It's like, yo, you got all this energy, man. Let me drop a little something on you.
Yeah.
And now in our discussion, I'm like, you can drop it, but don't be mad if they don't pick it up.
Yeah.
Don't be mad if they don't pick it up.
No. You can't be mad. I mean, look, it's just where they are in that moment in time, and their genetic code and their life journey. It's going to unfold, and it's all going to happen. And one day they're going to get. You know, I mean, it's in there. Like once you've said it, it's in there. Mm. You know what I mean? Now, is that wisdom bomb going to explode in that second or 10 years from now? Who knows? But you've planted it. Mm. Plant it and move on. You know what I'm saying? Plant it and move on. If the ground is fertile, a little grow in time, it's all good. Just, we shouldn't be so impatient as elders wanting, the youth to kind of, just change immediately. It's like, nothing really works that way,
Mm. Well, you just gave me an extra boost of energy. With that, because on my end, certain things I'm working on, I'm like, darn it, these people just aren't reacting the way I want to, and it is very much a seed planting type operation.
I do have one thing to say though, here's a seed I do want to plant, right? Mm-hmm. And this is even for you, just for what you just said. And I think you already know this, but this is maybe just as a point of encouragement. We just need to do the work. Mm. Just do the work. Do the work for the sake of doing the work. We have these desired outcomes, and it's great to have desires, because sometimes they help to get you motivated. But at the end of the day, we have to know that the work is worthy of doing for the sake of doing it, because we don't actually know how everything is going to play out. Hmm. We really don't know. Like, I mean, I can't draw the straight line between, East 58th Street between Tilden and Snyder, right, and being listed as one of the 100 most powerful business people in Nashville, Tennessee. I can't draw you that line. Mm-hmm. In any way, shape, or form. But you do the work, and opportunities come up, and people see things in you, and somebody finally gets what it is that you're talking about, and then things just start happening. But But we rarely, if ever, get to decide when and how the thing is going to happen. So it's just our job to do the work.
That's powerful, man. You know, you got all kinds of questions popping for me, because what it makes me think about the end, I'm like, okay, where does validation come in that? Where does validation fit in that? That's what just came to my mind. It's like, all right, do the work. Wait. Does that mean it's already validated? And so, you know, so I'm curious if it's like a, what's the right word here? It's a bigger do the work. You know, it's like a, it's a bigger sphere of do
yes.
the work.
Yes, yes. That's exactly right. When I'm talking about doing the work, I mean, if the first thing doesn't work, you know, different from doing the work, if the first thing doesn't work, meaning the first thing isn't validated right away, you know, look, don't do the work as in run into a brick wall 100 times, right? Mm-hmm. Like use your brain, right? But keep pushing towards the dream, you know? Mm-hmm. Yes, evolve. Yes, iterate. Yes, learn. Yes, change. Yes, grow. But keep doing the work. Like, you know, keep creating, keep waking up, keep growing in discipline, keep growing in self-governance, keep understanding that your commitment to especially creative work, like especially creative work, because creative work is one of those things that like you are never going to get good at creative work unless you put in a large amount of it, you know, and I would consider this show to be creative work, right? You know, this book that I'm working on right now, I mean, I wrote 700 words today. I don't feel great about it, but I wrote 700 words today. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think they're great 700 words, but they're 700 words. And tomorrow I'll write hopefully 1,500 or 2,000. And, you know, and maybe I'll feel better about those. I felt really good about the words I wrote on Tuesday. So some days feel good, some days don't. You know, maybe I'll, you know, turn around and read the words I wrote today and be like, wow, this is much better than I thought it was. But we just have to do the volume of work. The reason why I say that is because I see too many people, holding off from doing something because, you know, it's because they don't quote unquote like it, you know, and, you know, I hate to tell you, but like you're not going to be successful only doing the things you like. Mm-hmm. You know, that's everybody would be successful,
right?
If that's what it was, if it was just about doing the things we like, well, we could all do the things we like. You know, it's doing what's required that's a little bit harder.
Wow, that's powerful there, man. That's a quote right there. That's a tweet.
All right, well, it's yours.
That's a tweet right there, man. Wow, that is powerful. Well, kind of going off of the book part, usually I ask is if you had to recommend one book for someone just starting out in your path, what would it be? What are some of your favorite books?
I'm glad you asked what are some of my favorite books as opposed to the one book, because the one book question is always so hard.
Yeah.
One book that I really, really love, and I don't know that I could call it the book, but I really do love it. And it's one of those books that I just constantly see myself, you know, reaching back for. It's this book by a guy named David Allen called Getting Things Done. Mm-hmm. It's a book about productivity, and I'm not actually like a productivity maniac, right? Like I don't love micromanagement. I don't love project management per se. At least not in the typical way that people think about those things. But what I love about Getting Things Done is that what it does is it provides a very tangible, practical, applicable process for creating clarity about what is the most important next thing for you to do. And that clarity and that peace is such an advantage in this world of clutter and confusion and overstimulation. There's never been a time, I think, in recorded history where there were as many things to distract you as there are right now. It's just unbelievable how many things can distract you. And I think we're, you know, I'm not an expert in this by any means, but I believe that the overstimulation and the lack of kind of peace that comes from the constant distractions is leading to people being more prone to anxiety, more prone to feeling overwhelmed, more prone to feeling impotent, quite frankly. Like they can't create in the midst of all these other things that already exist and are constantly being created all the time. And the clarity and the peace of mind that comes with knowing what the next right thing is to do is magic. It really is. It's magic. And I've never read anything that has done that for me as succinctly as David Allen Getting Things Done. So it's a book that I never master. I don't expect to ever master it. I can look at my, like right now, my desk is, it's pretty cluttered, but I know exactly what to do. If I wanted to spend the next hour, I know exactly what to do to create clarity on my desk. And so I'm calm. You know what I mean? Like just knowing that makes me less anxious. So I think it's just an amazing thing, because one of the things I notice in this world is that people, the thing that shuts people down fastest is that they get overwhelmed too quickly, you know, way too quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a that's a powerful book. And I can't tell you the number of times that I've asked myself the question of how much time do I have and how much energy do I have, you know, to get something done. Like all those little pieces that it gives me a process. It gives me something to use. It's a very powerful book.
It is. I mean, you know, knowing that you can kind of reach back on it. I mean, I kind of think about it like, you know, I'm sure that people who have taken, you know, I didn't, and I wish that I didn't. I think I still might, actually. But I think about people who have actually studied martial arts, right? Mm-hmm. You've actually studied martial arts. And when you get into a situation, we've all kind of been in a situation where things get a little weird, a little amped up, you know, like somebody's looking like they're getting a little bit froggy, mm-hmm. you know. And when you don't fully know what you're going to do, you know, to like defend yourself, that doesn't feel great. It's kind of like an overwhelming feeling, you know, and the people who I know who, you know, have mastered a martial art, and I've been with them in these situations, they're always so calm, you know, because they understand what they can do in that situation to neutralize the threat. And just that knowledge makes them calm. And so, you know, when you have that knowledge and that ability to neutralize anything that's kind of negative in your life, it's powerful.
Definitely. Was there another book, or are you going to stay with that one?
Let's see. Can I come up with another one that I think is as potent as that book? Maybe give me a theme, you know, and maybe I can come up with something.
Let's see. What comes to mind based on our conversation? There's something about like startup and not having, like, not being part of that group that has the finance piece. It's like, what is this thing? Like someone who just stumbled upon the word startup. You know,
yeah.
What is this thing you speak of? What is this thing you speak of called startup?
Yeah, that's a great one. You know, I honestly, one of the reasons why I'm writing this book is because I think most of the books are written over people's heads, and written kind of for you know, the technorati and the Silicon Valley crew and the elite. So I can't make a ton of recommendations other than, you know, hopefully you'll appreciate my book when it comes out. I will say that one of the most foundational books, I think, for the way that people think about startups and the adoption of innovation is a book called The Four Steps to Epiphany. It's written by Steve Blank. He is a professor of entrepreneurship at Stanford. I believe he's still there. At least he was when he wrote the book, and had been for some time. In this book, Four Steps to Epiphany, he details a process called customer development. And that really is very, very foundational to so many other books. Like, you know, people talk about this book called The Lean Startup or the right. whole Lean Startup movement. But really, Four Steps to Epiphany happened first, quite frankly. And so, you know, if you were going to understand the foundational, you know, writing about it, it would be Steve Blank's Four Steps to the Epiphany. And it's pretty, you know, it is a good book. I mean, I think, you know, it's not a book that I go back to over and over again because, you know, I think once you get the concept once, I don't think you need to read that book over and over again. Mm-hmm. And the basics of the concept are just the difference between an organization that is creating a business model, and then back to that word, validating a business model, versus an organization that has a business model that has been proven, has been validated, and then they are growing that company, right? Like those are two different types of organizations because the things they need to do operationally are different. So one is much more investigative, and the other one is, I would say, you know, just much more kind of productivity focused. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the things that you would be doing in the investigative phase have already been figured out, proven, kind of written as law. And so then you're just mostly about productivity, delivery, things like that. So it's a really good book for kind of explaining the difference between the two organizations, and it goes pretty deep into what he believes a startup organization should be structured as. Lots of people have taken a lot of different takes on his foundational position around that, but I think he does a pretty good job of it.
Oh, great. Thank you for that. Now, this is the part where you get to brag. Where can the people find you and your work online?
Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to get into this social media game kind of before everybody you know, felt like they needed to. So just about everywhere online, I'm at Marcus Whitney. You know, that'd be Twitter, Instagram, pretty much any platform where there's a username. If it's Marcus Whitney, I probably have it. And then for Jumpstart Foundry, if you want to learn more kind of about the things we're doing in healthcare innovation, then jumpstartfoundry.com, you can find us there. And for The Unlikely Company, that's still very much in development right now. So sticking with Marcus Whitney is probably the best way to stay in tune with what's going on there.
Excellent. Well, Marcus, we really appreciate you taking the time, stepping away from the writing and the CEOing and the presidenting. So we appreciate the time and the wisdom, man.
Awesome, man. Hey, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure, and I hope I can come back on the show sometime.
Yeah, definitely after the book, man. We'll have to do something, maybe a blab.
Perfect. Perfect. Sounds good, bro.
All right, man. Today's show was sponsored by Meet Edgar. Quick question for you. If you post a tweet about something you think is important and no one sees it, did it have an impact? You're spending time writing, uploading, and scheduling updates, and they usually don't even get seen by most of your followers. Meet Edgar is the only scheduler that directly addresses that and stops your updates from going to waste by automatically saving and sharing them again and again over time. Because you're spending way less time on busy work, you can dedicate more of your time to creating dope content and actually interacting with your followers. They call it social media for a reason. Visit meetedgar.com to learn more and start your free 14-day trial today. Thank you, dear listener, for being with us. Did you find today's message valuable? Love the show? Subscribe at bit.ly/NMRD support, all lowercase. You'll get podcast episodes, updates, and articles sent directly to your inbox. If you sign up right now, you'll get a free 10-part email series called The 10 Career Commandments. Now, everything we create, everything we share, is designed to empower young professionals of color like you. Go ahead and move forward. We got your back. Tired of going at this alone? Request access to our Facebook group by visiting bit.ly/FB group_NMRD. NMRD stands for No More Reasonable Doubt. As always, our goal is to take you from invisible to invincible. I'm your host, Mike Ambassador Bruni, and the dope beat you're about to hear to close out the show is by Papa Doc. Peace.